It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. Coming up at noon, fresh air and a look at mobsters in small town America. We, of course, think of, you know, big cities, Vegas, Chicago, where the mob had significant presence, Miami Beach. But small town America place too, where organized crime had significant influence. That's the focus, the new book, Small Time, and its author, Russell Shorto, on Fresh Air with Terry Gross at noon here on KPECC. Well, in this year of the pandemic, it's changed our lives in so many ways, so very dramatically, and particularly for Americans who live alone, who are single. It's been a withdrawal in many cases from physical touch, physical contact, whether it's holding someone's hand, whether it's kissing, whether it's hugging, having someone next to you in same physical place who you're not related to, isn't part of a bubble. All of this, of course, is fraught now. And the question is, what are the ways in which we deal with that, we compensate for that, cope with that lack? I'd like to hear from you if that's been your circumstance these past several months. How have you dealt with the comparative absence of touch? 866-893-KPCC. You can tweet at AirTalk, post on the AirTalk page, and post on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. With me from the University of Arizona Health Sciences, Professor of Physiology, Neurology, and Neuroscience, Katalin Gotthard. She leads a team of neuroscientists and trainees studying brain activity underlying emotional and social behaviors. Professor Gotthard, thank you very much for being with us today. Let's talk first of all about the wired need that we have for touch. Why is it so important?
Thank you for the invitation. I'm delighted to be on your show. I think we are primates, and the primates live in highly structured societies. And touch, more than anything else, is one of the bonding behaviors between primates. It starts with maternal behavior in early life, but it continues through adulthood through touch that is a form of reassuring, of reinforcing connections, of investing in our trusting relationships.
Talk a bit also about just how our skin in literal touch, what physiologically happens when others touch us.
Yes, so we have in our skin a whole array of receptors. Some of these serve the so-called haptics, the way we learn about the texture, the shape, the weight, the size of objects that our skin come in contact with. But there's also a set of receptors that are activated through gentle sweeping movements of light pressure. Basically, in neuroscience or in physics, you can define motion, but the word for it is actually caress. These receptors are fine-tuned to detect this light, gentle touch, and they're even sensitive to the temperature of the object that does the caressing. So we are set up and we come into the world already with a mature touch system that is capable from our first moment of life to understand and interpret touch that is so important, especially in early life, to build this relationship with the caretaker. Every baby deserves the protective embrace of a parent.
Now, I understand that some of the research you've been involved with goes back a number of years to orphans in Romania who, because of the staffing level there, were denied of being held, being touched, when they were very young. And what did that research show about that experience?
This is really fascinating, and it took me several decades to actually understand what I witnessed and what I experienced there as a medical student during my clerkship in pediatrics, and what I know now about touch as a neuroscientist. So it turns out that the lack of touch can kill you, and this is not an exaggeration. These children fail to thrive, and we always thought that they fail to thrive, which is basically a way of saying institutionalized children become very sick and die. They fail to thrive, and we always thought that it was because of malnutrition or infections or an immune compromise. But now we know that it was their complete solitude, their complete deprivation of social-emotional stimulation, which comes as a major form, especially for children, especially for preverbal children, in the shape of touch. And then later on, when in the laboratory we found that the emotional center of the brain, the amygdala, which is the area that we study for the last couple of decades, contains these brain cells that are tuned to touch, then I immediately switched the direction of my research. And today we know that this sense is absolutely essential for our well-being.
Professor, what about those individuals who can't tolerate being touched? They're highly sensitive to it. It makes them feel very, very anxious or uncomfortable. Do we understand what's going on there, and does that in any way enlighten us about, you know, this overall response to touch?
So there's three things that I think belong to the answer to your question. The first question is, we know that there are disorders such as autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders where there is a sensitivity, an oversensitivity to any kind of sensory stimulation. So that goes in their own category, and that has to do with organic, structural, functional changes in the nervous system. Then we're talking about people who have been traumatized or abused, and they have now an interpretation. They have an aversion to touch because they have a conditioned response to touch because that evokes unpleasant memories. And finally, there are people who do not like to be touched, and this comes from a cultural background. And in the U.S., it's typically the generation who has been brought up during the heightened era of behaviorism, when psychologists like Watson told mothers not to pick up their babies if they cry, not to hug them, not to kiss them. And that behaviorist conceptual framework of raising children led to a generation of people who do not understand and do not trust the signals that they receive through touch, and sometimes they even interpret them in purely sexual terms.
So funny, my father, for so many years of my life, which is not a hugger, not a toucher, and I started, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, you know, giving him a hug and all. Now he so looks forward to it. Didn't take long to get past that barrier of earlier. We're talking with University of Arizona Health Sciences Professor of Physiology, Neurology, and Neuroscience, Katalin Gotthard. We're talking about her research into how we process human touch and why we have such a need for it. This, the occasion of our conversation, of course, is the comparative absence of touch for so many of us who are locked down during the course of the pandemic, which, you know, for months has meant for many people an absence of hugs, a touching, even a kiss on the cheek that might have been standard in the past. We can't do that now except for people that are in our bubble. I'm also going to introduce our second guest from Texas State University in just a moment, Marion Hauser. But I want to bring a listener into the conversation from Southgate. It's Liz. Liz, good to have you with us. And share with us how this affects you, this challenge about touch.
Yeah, so being a Mexican, you know, greeting each other with kisses on the cheeks and hugs, it's just so standard that it was really hard to get used to. And it's still, you know, something that I miss very much. And it's especially hard when, you know, I see my nieces and nephews and they run to me and, you know, want to hug me. And that's definitely been the toughest part, just, you know, seeing them run to me and kind of, you know, telling them to hold back.
Yeah, Liz, have you found any way of attempting to replicate some of that safely, or or does even talking about, you know, with your family, how much you miss that help to bring some of those feelings up?
Well, with the little ones, I definitely had to talk to them and, you know, remind them that we're all going through this and that they have to be more careful because of, you know, my parents or their grandparents. But I pretty much just started telling everybody that I love them very much. And I think it hits even more now because, you know, you just never know what the future holds for anybody these days.
Boy, is that true. Liz, thank you for sharing it and providing the cultural perspective as well, because that is a good point that there are cultural differences, even family cultural differences. You know, some families just hugging is so much a part of the bonding, of the communication. Other families, you know, not. So maybe that's not missed as much because it's not part of that particular, you know, family system. As I mentioned, communication studies professor at Texas State University and co-founder of Living Mental Wellness, a holistic mental wellness training program, Marion Hauser. Thank you very much, Professor Hauser, for being with us. You want to comment on Liz's call, first of all?
Of course. Thanks, Larry. Thank you for having me. We see this a lot. I live in South Texas, and so I hear many students and adults talking about the lack of connection that their families and cultural groups are used to. So we talk about it, and of course that helps, and we engage in conversation via, you know, some technology, but we try to tell them that there are things they can do activity-wise with their family, even online, that can sometimes create the feeling of a social bond. And we talk a lot about the mind-body connection, and you can trick your brain a little bit into getting those benefits of serotonin produced in your system, which regulates your mood. And if you can trick your mind into that, and it is easy to do when you feel pleasure talking to and visiting with family, just seeing their faces. So I would suggest that they frequently engage in online conversations and get the family together laughing, because it really can work. It'll never replace it, but it certainly helps.
I'm glad to hear you talk about this. That's kind of what I was getting at with my question of Liz. If you know, talking about it, sort of, you know, even sharing about the lack of it in a sense helps to bring up the historic memories of that good feeling. It sounds like that's a bit of what you're talking about here too.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And we, you know, you talk scientifically that serotonin is produced whether it's a real or imagined situation. So maybe it's not so much a trick as it is a reflection of what you remember it feeling like or being like. And I certainly believe that if you can engage in those connections with family and friends, especially if you're laughing and carrying on your day-to-day conversations with them, I believe that you could get yourself to that point where you could feel those emotional connections and bonds. Yep.
Yeah, we're going to talk with Christina in Hollywood in a moment. She's going to talk about what this has been like with her family. Want to hear from you, just like from Christina and from Liz so far, what the absence of touch for those outside your bubble, what that's been like for you, for family members. Have you found effective ways of at least temporarily trying to recapture the communication that has gone on in that physical way, doing it verbally or in other forms of communication? Very pleased to be joined by Professors Marion Hauser of Texas State and Katalin Gotthard of Arizona, University of Arizona. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. Our poster Silas on the Air Talk page, he so often anticipates what the next point I'm going to bring up in the interview. It's almost a little eerie. Silas, I'm going to bring that up in a moment, what you just posted about. But first, I want to talk with Christina in Hollywood. Christina, thank you for joining us. How has the absence of touch played out in your family?
You know, Larry, it has been pretty tough, especially since the virus. I also come from a Mexican family, and we always kiss and hug, hello, goodbye. And my mother had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer the week that everything shut down. And I work at a homeless shelter. And so I was not able to, or didn't feel like I could, hug my mother or comfort her during this time where she had been diagnosed throughout the entire illness, and she has passed away since. She was diagnosed in March. And it just, you know, kills me because I was not able to comfort her. And if all this hadn't been happening, things might have been a little different.
It's just terrible that you didn't have that chance. Christina, have you talked with your other family members about this? Is this something that you've been able to comfort each other with, your mom's survivors?
You know, we really haven't discussed it. It was just so, we didn't know what to do, you know, when she was diagnosed. And at the same time, I'm a teacher at a homeless shelter. So I was, you know, exposed to things that, you know, maybe other people haven't been exposed to. And my brother's also a teacher, and, you know, everything kind of shut down, and we all just were there with her, but we didn't feel we were, you know, it was safe enough to hug her or hold her hand. And she had to go to every single appointment by herself from the first one to the last. Mm.
Christina, I so appreciate you sharing this. And one thing's clear, your mom's legacy lives on in the work of you and your brother. And so that's a wonderful thing. The critical work that you two are doing as teachers and under those circumstances. But let me go back to Professor Marian Hauser of Texas State University. This has been devastating, not just for the family members like Christina, but for healthcare providers who see this. I was watching an interview on CBS this morning with a nurse. He was an Army nurse who was working in a hospital, I think in Riverside here in Southern California. And he just broke down and started crying over the fact that a man who was dying, his wife had to, you know, decide which of the kids, you know, only could bring one in to see him at the very end. This is just emotionally devastating.
Yes, it is. And you know, your guest talked about family not really knowing what to say about it. And of course, that I understand that. I think one of the most important things, and we tell our healthcare providers, is that talking about it is what needs to be done, needs to happen, and sharing the emotions and the feelings needs to happen, because no one's dealing with this alone, that's for certain. And the stress that they're feeling in trying to comfort their patients is extremely difficult. And so they've got to find a way to relieve some of that stress. And part of that is by talking about it, and is by having a conversation and exercising and getting outside, stimulating oneself. So it's tough, but I would encourage your caller earlier to sit down with family and have that tough conversation.
Christina, I hope it's helpful. You know, the tens of thousands of people listening right now have been moved by your story and care about what you're going through. And for some of them, they can also personally relate because they've had something similar. So we wish you all the best. Thank you for sharing that. Let me go back to Professor, University of Arizona Health Sciences, Katalin Gotthard. Professor Gotthard, along the same lines what we're talking about with Professor Hauser, are there some sorts of workarounds that we can do when we're in this physically limited environment to get some of the same benefit that we get from human touch when it's not available?
Yes, I particularly liked her point about talking about it. So I will explain why I think it's more important to talk about it than to be together, and then I'll tell you other ways of compensating for it. So the first idea is that when we're trying to be socially distanced, something very funny happens to our brain. We experience a cognitive dissonance. because in our brain, the cells that respond to disgust, it's the same cell that responds to concrete disgust of a disgusting piece of food and moral disgust towards somebody who's a despicable person. Same thing with distancing. When we want to distance ourselves from somebody because we feel emotionally distanced, we pull away or we roll our chair backward, we lean backward. You want to establish the physical distance. So when we're trying to be with our loved one in this socially distancing situation, our words are saying the connectedness, the closeness, and our physical gestures are telling our brain distance, distancing, disgust, rejection. So it's almost better not to be there, not to be there at 6 feet with mask and not to be able to touch. Because if we are on the phone or our Zoom, we already accept the limitation and we don't experience this distance.
That makes sense to me.
And then the other thing is that just as Marianne explained, there are ways of compensating. I think our body is in withdrawal, so we need to give the body the stimulation. Do a good, vigorous massage of your head in the shower. Don't be shy of massaging and caressing yourself. Also, have a pet. Stroke a living, warm, responding body. There are ways in which we can actually satisfy a little bit, even though not as we were meant to experience social touch. But there's a way in which we can still hug the people around us with whom we are in a pod and we are safe. We can touch our pets. We can give ourselves sufficient tactile sensory stimulation to compensate, even if not fully, this hunger for touch symptoms, for touch stimuli, this sort of to mitigate a little bit the actual withdrawal that our brain experiences.
I'm so glad you mentioned pets. That's what Sila posted on our page. A dog or a cat or even another type of pet that we can have that physical touch with. And I think we've seen people's relationships with their pets, particularly with the humans being home so much more, those relationships become all the closer. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Professor Marianne Hauser, Texas State University, Professor Caitlin Gotard of the University of Arizona. From all of us at AirTalk, have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air is next, and it's a very special Take Two with A. Martinez coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon.